For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
I robbed other churches by accepting their contributions so I could serve you at no cost. And when I was with you and didn't have enough to live on, I did not become a financial burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia brought me all I needed. I have never been a burden to you, and I never will be. Boy, it just seems like that's an odd paragraph, isn't it? Something's going on in this group. And what's going on in this group is kind of highlighted by this idea that Paul's saying, look, I'm not expecting anything from you. I've never been a burden to you, never will be. The background here is that there were some people in Corinth, and we've been talking as we've studied 1 and 2 Corinthians all along, it's been clear. Here is a group that is really kind of a rabble. They're disunified. They're fighting with one another. And a lot of what they're fighting over, or at least some of it, has to do with things that Paul has had to say to them and that has brought, you know, a sense of offense to some. And one of the things that Paul's, I guess we could say, you know, opposition in this group was saying about Paul is that he's just like all these other traveling philosophers, these sophists, these orators. They come in with some persuasive rap, and the whole reason that they're doing that is because that's how they make their livelihood. In other words, they're in it for the money. So imagine that, religion and money. Some things never change. And so, you know, just like today, we're very suspicious of what people have to say because we wonder, what is your underlying motive? So it was with people in Paul's day. To such an extent, we learn from this passage and in others as well, that Paul had made it his policy, and he spent a year and a half in this city, made it his policy that he would not take a single dime from anyone, would not receive as a gift anything from anybody in the city of Corinth, because he wanted to make it clear, no, I'm not doing this for reasons of advantage. I'm not profiting in any way by the things that I'm doing. And so, you know, one could imagine it got pretty bizarre at a certain point when Paul is insistent, I've never taken anything from anyone and I never will. You know, a guy like Paul, you know, I would find very interesting conversationally. I'd like to get to know a person like that. I would have a strong inclination for a guy like Paul to invite him over to our house. I mean, can you imagine, you know, my dinner with Paul? You know, that would be pretty awesome. Much more interesting than Andre. And so you put the food out on the table. You're ready for, you know, a pleasant interaction. And Paul reaches into his pocket and puts a $10 bill on the table. You're like, you know, what? What? What's this? You are my guest. I want to hear from you. I've been looking forward to this for weeks. Yeah, I've been looking forward to it too. But it's my policy. I don't take anything from anyone around here. So, take my $10. No, I insist, really. We just want to hear from you. Well, it's like this. Either you take my 10 or I have to go. That's really bizarre to imagine that there would be a situation like that. But in reality, it did sort of come down to just that. Because Paul wanted to make it really clear. There is no profit incentive. There's no motive for me to be doing what I'm doing here with this message and so forth. I don't want you to confuse in any way me with these religious charlatans that are all over the place. So that's the background, and out of it comes a couple of fairly important principles that I'd like to discuss here tonight that really relate, I think, to the heart of what is it like, you know, in a broad sense, to be about the things that God thinks are important in life. And what are the attitudes that we see in Paul right here that are necessary, really, to accomplish the things in life that God has brought us around to for the sake of accomplishing? A ministry, a work of service, in other words, that God has for you. What are the principles that drive that? A couple of the big ones are here. And the first we can see in this passage. There's an orientation to life that Paul describes here. And when we look at what Paul's talking about, he uses pretty strong language. He says, I spoke to you the good news without expecting anything in return. Well, that's important, not expecting anything in return. And I think probably for most of us, when we think about our underlying motivations for serving people, getting involved in the things of God, it would be a stretch to say, yeah, you know, I never expect anything from anyone. I expect nothing in return for the things that I do. Now, some people maybe, you know, are noble like that, like our brother Greg. He's this way. Everyone who knows him says that. But for the rest of us, you know, we kind of feel like we are a blend of motivations. Do you sense that within yourself? You know, sometimes you feel like I really am properly motivated. My desire is to put the things of God and people first before myself. And then I just kind of catch myself, you know, thinking, oh, I've been thinking about myself all day long. So which is it? Well, it's a combination of those things. And our question tonight is, on what trajectory do we find ourselves? Where are we moving in our life? What is the basic orientation of our value system as followers of Jesus Christ? That's what we want to talk about in relation to this idea of not expecting anything in return. What does he mean by that? I think that he's reflecting an orientation, an outlook that we can contrast by kind of the dominant view of how we're taught to think about things in our culture, a self-orientation, versus the perspective that Paul is bringing to the table here, a servanthood kind of orientation. Let's just break it down a little bit and kind of think about this together. In self-orientation, when I'm thinking about, you know, what I'm really all about to me, what's really important is me, you know, commitment always has to flow back to me. Why do I do the things that I do? Because I find advantage in them. Because I find them rewarding. Because I find them interesting. Why do I connect with the people I do? Because they do something for me. And so there's always that kind of caveat. At the end of the day, my motivation, ultimately, my sense of satisfaction, the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing is because I'm sensing a benefit here. Now, one of the things that kind of brings this out oftentimes for us is who I'm willing to move toward relationally. Who am I willing to move toward? It's kind of a revealing thought here. Who do I call up? Who do I connect with? Who do I think about? You know, a lot of us will find that the people that really occupy our interest, just as it so happens, are people who like us, people who are like us, people that we connect with and that we get some sort of a sense of benefit from. When you think, I'll bet Torg feels really alone. He's sitting at his table all by himself. You know, no one will associate with this guy. And for good reason. Okay. Now, it's true. One orientation would have it that, you know, getting involved with him is just, it's just a little more than should be expected of me. So I ignore him like everybody else. Okay? It's my orientation. Who am I willing to move toward? Not the person that's going to be taxing for me or that I sense might be taxing for me. I avoid that person because that's a drain on my energy. It's a rain on my parade. It's really getting me involved with things that I just, you know, they're not really going to help me in any way. So I'm going to avoid that person. And it is possible for many of us to look around at our relational investments and realize, you know, how come it is I only gravitate towards the people that I really like and don't really have a sense in my own head that it's the need of the other that drives the decisions that I make, not what am I getting from that person. And I think that that's just a normal kind of struggle. It's a significant one, though, if we're going to have this kind of attitude that Paul describes. Relationships. For a person who is basically operating out of self and believing that commitments always have to flow back to me eventually, here are people who look at the relationships they have more or less in a calculated way as negotiations. What am I getting out of this versus what I'm putting into it? There's a cost-benefit analysis done. And if at the end of the day, you know, you got the parentheses around the figure, then it's forget it. And a lot of us will keep very long lists of people who owe us in relationship, don't we? Aren't we this way? And what is that saying? That's saying that you are in my debt, you owe me, and in that sense, then, I have legitimate expectations that you are going to, what, maybe come groveling back to me, you're going to do this thing for me, whatever it might be. Boy, in a marriage relationship, and I've talked to a lot of people who are married over a lot of years at this point, it is remarkable to me how long some of these lists get in terms of detail and also in terms of how long these debts have been outstanding. And so you've got people sometimes who have this seed of anger and bitterness towards their spouse because they were done wrong back in 1977. You know, and it's just ever since then, you know, I just can't look at that person the same again, you know, and this type of thing. And we're expecting that relationships are these contracts where you meet me part way. And you owe me to the extent that you do not. We think in terms of the self-orientation that success is advancement. And the clearest place to see that, of course, is in the job environment. If I'm doing well, I expect to be compensated, I expect to be promoted, and of course, I expect to be praised. What a great person you are. And, you know, we expect that you will perform because why? Because we value you so much. And so the world has learned the value of encouraging people to get them to do basically what they want them to do. But all I'm saying is that we are really kind of sculpted out of this same rock in our culture. We are really taught to be self-oriented. We are taught that you give involved in relationships because you know that ultimately that's in your self-interest. And so when there's a sense that there's not self-interest involved here, we are very much inclined to leave Torg alone and so forth like that. On the other hand, you know, this attitude that Paul describes here is that, okay, here I am in Corinth, I believe that God has brought me to this place, I don't think that the people that God has brought into my life are here by any sort of accident, because I believe that God is a sovereign God, that God brings people together to accomplish His purposes in our life. And that is a way different kind of attitude than the thought that commitments are there to flow back to me, because a person like this says, I want to be ready for the people that God brings into my life to stand in there and to be a real servant of God for that person. Why is this person in my life? It's because God wants to use me in some way to further His purposes and His call in their life. So a person like Paul, who's looking and he's basing his decisions and he's basing, you know, how does he conduct himself among these Corinthians without expecting anything in return, he says, because I'm not there for me. I'm there totally to meet your needs, to meet your interests. And so such a person, if we are going to be able to have this kind of value that Paul describes, what does it take? One of the things it takes is a little bit of thought life. A little bit of effort there to think, you know, I wonder if I know this person well enough to even know what their needs are that God brought me into their life in order that I might help need. You know, so there's that thought that I'll need to take some initiative here and that I need to actually become interested in their world and that my conversations are not monologues about myself interrupted by interrogatives like enough about me, what do you think about me? to really probe in there and to discover some things about them. We want to find out, we believe that they're not there by accident in your life. And so we want to find out what's God doing in this person's life that we can cooperate with and that we can get along with. That's a very important and different kind of outlook. That if we are giving and we are involved in these relationships expecting nothing in return, what that means is that we are in a very conscious way setting aside our rights. You know, we believe that we have rights to be treated a certain kind of way, and indeed we do. But it is at that place where we are demanding our rights and making the honoring of those rights as a precondition for relationship with that other person that we will necessarily fail. And why is that? Because people will fail you. And your rights won't be protected. And they will stomp right on them. And they will offend you in various kinds of ways. And there we have a decision to make. Will I take offense and move back? Or will I forgive and move toward? And every single valuable relationship you have will be defined exactly along those lines. It's so simple, it's frightening. Okay? It's so simple, it's frightening. Will you forgive offenses done to you so that you can continue to be available to move into their world to meet their needs? That doesn't make any sense, does it? How different that is from the self-orientation that expects things to flow your way, and when it doesn't, then you move on. Paul says, I didn't expect anything in return. Advancement is not determined by, you know, big pats on the back and this type of thing. But advancement is defined in terms of our capacity, our skill, and at the art of loving people effectively and having real impact in their life. And it can become very pleasing, in fact, when you begin to realize at a certain point, you know, I do have skills that do matter in terms of moving into this person's life and helping them move along. And to advance in those skills means that our whole lives are, and our outlook is beginning to change as we take a sense of pleasure from something that's good, something that God is really all about. And so, for this person who is a servant, who's not there for self, praise is not required. We don't have to continuously giving the pat on the back and this type of thing, because that's really not why they're motivated to begin with. Which, of course, does not mean that we shouldn't encourage each other and praise the things that we see. But again, is it a demand that I will move forward only to the extent that I'm recognized, that I'm acknowledged, that my contribution is totally valued in some way, that my reputation just kind of wafts through the atmosphere and everyone's like, oh, yeah, you know, you, yeah. You know, if that's your condition, you will never get very far in Christian work. It's not going to happen. The self-oriented person ultimately is driven by fear. Fear that because I need everything to flow to me to begin with, I need to be asking myself, am I getting my fair share? And so we will look at how we interact with people and the things that we're involved with in life by asking this question of ourselves. We worry, is it really paying off for me? And so, you know, I'm concerned about this issue of getting what do I deserve? And so a person who is oriented in this way will need to control their environment. They will need to control relationships. They will need to control the things that make for their self-interested contentment. But because those things involve circumstances and people that they can't just wind up like a toy, they know I'm at risk. There's a danger here. And so a person who is self-oriented will seek by many ways to control the outlook and the behavior of other people so that they can get what they want. Women do this. Men do this. It's just a part of the human experience that we are, you know, just to be perfectly blunt with you, at the core of it, in relationships, human beings are manipulators. And we look to the other person by nature. We look to the other person to say, how can they accomplish for me what I want them to do? That's the way we are by nature. And I think that that is really a crucial thing, just to recognize in yourself. That is a driver in your own life. And how do you assess that? How do you think about that? It becomes very important. For the person driven by this sort of a fear, this awareness of the fact that they're committed to their own needs but aren't necessarily sure they're going to be able to pull that off, you know, envy can be a big problem here. I see this other person not struggling to get what they want. How come I have to struggle so hard to get what I want? And so we become envious of the things that people own, of their successes. Have you ever? No, probably not you. Maybe one or two of you. The rest of you don't have to listen. There are some people who, when they see other people succeed, it actually bums them out. But not you, of course. The person who looks to the other person's success and says, I'm nothing in comparison to that. Or it's not fair that they should have that and I am deprived of this thing or whatever. You know, and people are driven by that sense of envy. Again, I know none of you, but some people out there are like that. The priorities, you know, at the end of the day tend to exclude real sacrifice. And so as Christians, of course, we all know what we're supposed to think. We all know what we're supposed to value. We all believe that we are called by God to live a sacrificial life because, I mean, that's, after all, it's what Jesus is all about, right? So we say that and we believe that, but some of us will find at the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the month, at the end of the year, at the end of conscious memory, man, I just never had time to put the needs and the concerns of other people before my own. Just, it's just so weird, you know, for me, you know, the demands of my self-interest are just so weighty that I couldn't get to it. And I know that there you are, you're bleeding and so forth, and I can salve that wound, but, you know, I'm just so busy with my thing that I just can't get to that. You know, we are busy people. We are very busy people. I think I shared it here some months ago. We were talking about, you know, careers in America and so forth. And the data has shocked me that American families actually work more hours than Japanese families do. I couldn't believe that when I first read that. And what is it saying? It's saying that we are deeply, frenetically involved in accomplishing and in acquiring. And for many of us, you know, that's the center of the plate. And we've got, you know, of course, the needs and the concerns of our children and stuff like that. And then after we've sort of satisfied those needs, you know, I'm fried and there's just nothing left for me anymore. So a lot of Christians find themselves, quite frankly, on the horns of a dilemma. I believe that living for the things of God is the most important thing in life. I live like what is really important to me is me. And it's going to be just really important for us to say, how am I going to conduct my life? Am I going to just going to be floating on the current that drives this culture, that drives what people value, what drives people are about? Or am I going to stop and say, okay, what I'm basically about and what I see that I've been about has really very little to do on the issue of what does it mean for me to learn how to be effective in loving other people, of being a real, informed, articulate, effective representative of Jesus Christ in the lives of the people around me. And we're going to have to just come before God, I think, at a certain point and say, if I believe that those things are true, then I need, for the sake of my own integrity as a person, as a child of God, to figure out what does it take for me then to begin to live what I really believe. Because the tide of culture will never bring you to that place. And it's just, you've got to stop and you've got to think it through. And people are making decisions a lot about their careers, about all kinds of things in their life. Because we realize, you know, if I let the world define the rules, I will never get around to the things that God calls me to. It just won't happen. Okay, it's a danger for a lot of us who are successful and are busy. On the other hand, eschewing the self-orientation, the servant finds a profound level of freedom, paradoxically, namely that they're not burdened with this constant neurotic drive to make sure everything flows in their direction and they're getting their due. And I think there's something really beautiful about this. A person who really understands what Paul is talking about here, I don't expect anything in return, is a person who is mortified by the thought that we could be motivated by the idea of getting what we deserve. Because what would happen if you got what you deserve? You know, I'm telling you, it would be bad news. And God is saying, I will not, you know, every religion known to man says that you're to be treated according to what you deserve. You know, the thought life of humanity is that if I do good things, then I expect good things to come back to me in more or less the same measure and so forth. And there's lots of terms for that. It's law, it's karma, it's a lot of different kinds of things. But the servant is the one who realizes with some humility, if I get what I deserve because God has shown me the darkness of my heart, I don't want what I deserve. And it is the fundamental key to understanding the Christian message. That sense of self that tells you, as much as I may try to convince myself, I'm really not okay with God. I'm really not, you know, one with Him or whatever. That I've got a real problem. I've got a moral problem. I'm alienated from God. And there is nothing that I can do to bridge that alienation, to bridge that chasm. And if that's not something that you have come to understand, you can't be a Christian. Because Christianity is not about getting, you know, God in your life like a pep pill to help you pursue your agenda with more vigor and effectiveness, or a ticket to make you wealthy, or whatever it is that people sell and the people around Paul were selling as well. It's that humble realization that I can either come before God self-satisfied and self-righteously, or humbly saying, I need a handout. And there's no way to bring those two things together. And so just to be able to come before God and say, be merciful to me, I'm a sinful person. I want to believe and trust that what you've done for me on the cross is sufficient to deal with my problem with you, and that you are pursuing me in relationship and asking me, will I respond to your offer in the cross? You know, if we say yeah to that, we say, yeah, I do believe that. I do want you in my life. And I realize it's on the basis of what you have done and not has nothing to do with what I deserve. Then we are qualified to understand the real love of God, the grace of God, the mercy of God. And such a person, recognizes instinctively and intuitively that I never get involved with people thinking I'm going to get what I deserve. Dessert never comes into the equation because we've already parted ways with that kind of earning acceptance and earning the acclaim of the other and so forth like that. I don't think about what's fair for me and what I deserve. And as a consequence, there's a freedom from that, because now I'm not using other people as kind of a leverage to get me what I really want in life. And that I'm free in that sense just to say, man, my life is a gift from God. I don't deserve anything. Nothing at all. I deserve nothing. And because I don't deserve anything, what I receive is a gift from Him. And I can just, in a selfless way, enter into the lives of other people and freely give what has been freely given to me. And how powerful it is when we get that through our heads, that that's what life is really about. Jesus says, freely you have received, freely give. And if you realize the enormity through which God has met you and given you all that you have, then this enables you to just be freed up to say, I trust my life to a good God, and I'm going to be concerned about the people that He's concerned about. And when we live like this, not in a self-protective way, but in a self-giving way, the really cool thing that happens is that we begin to experience real transformation in our own lives. You know, there's nothing more corrosive to our emotional life than to be self-absorbed. There's nothing more mind-numbing than being all about me. There's nothing more socially alienating than predicating relationships on what's in it for me. And when we put those things aside and we begin to just move into other people's lives and to forgive and to serve and to express interest and come alongside these people, God reorients our emotional life. We find actually that we derive a sense of pleasure from the advances of other people and for the good things that are happening in their life. That we feel a sense of the depression maybe that for some of us just dominates our life, like, and just this heavy load, you know, becomes lighter because the eye is off of self and onto the interests and the concerns of other people. And you wake up one day realizing, God, it's been months since I've been mind-numbingly depressed. Why? Because I've had some freedom from self. And so it's a sweet thing in that way. Finally, in terms of just comparison here, you know, the person who's all about themselves is ultimately discontent. They're driven by desires for self that will not be fulfilled or unrealistic to have fulfilled, and it just isn't going to happen. Because, how come? Because everybody else they're involved with, for the most part, is the same way. I use you, you use me. That doesn't bring people together. It just rips people to shreds. That's what it is. And so a person who's experienced life in this way, in this more or less what's in it for me sort of way in relationship, over time becomes increasingly apathetic, increasingly selfish. And the competitiveness that has drawn them to other people, to conquer them, to get what they want out of them, at a certain point, people around them realize what this person's about, and there's real distance. And you may be sitting here tonight, like the consensus of Americans today, realizing I don't really have anyone really close in my life that I can share my heart with, that I know will be there for me, regardless of what is going on in my life. And the reason's going to be is because that's exactly the way you are. You're the selfish person who doesn't care about the others, and that's why everyone has been kept at arm's length, and they're not there for you. You're right about that. And the answer to that is not to control and cajole and demand that people care. It's to begin to give yourself authentically and really to the needs and interests of other people. That's the only way that changes. People will often have a very persistent sense of being wronged or a fatalism about their life or about the future. And there is a one-to-one correlation between that kind of sense of I've just been screwed at every turn and this type of thing, and the future is just, you know, this black box or whatever. You know, there is a one-to-one correlation between that and this other point. about how it is that I have interacted and viewed myself in relation to other people. On the other hand, the person who really adopts what Paul's describing here, giving without expecting anything in return, is a person who does experience in a profound way peace, within, and a sense of joy, even optimism in certain ways about life. You know, when your desires and God's desires are the same, there's something really profound happening in your heart. You want the very thing that the Lord wants. And that sense of just being about what He's about. You know, there is that awareness that you have. There's an experience that begins to develop of closeness with God because you're moving the same way. You want what He wants. Similarly, as we kind of come alongside one another in this way, and we're not just me, but we are about this whole idea of what does it mean for me to be a servant, then we begin to develop, you know, some very deep bonds among the people that you're doing life with. And this is thrilling, and it's rewarding, and there's a depth of connection with people that you are in like-minded way serving with that is just completely unparalleled, I think, in any other kind of human relationship and human experience. And it's a beautiful thing. And there are just dozens of you here tonight who know what I'm talking about, the closeness that comes from knowing that we're reading off the same page together. And that I don't fear my relationship with you because I know that you are, like me, committed to saying no to the self and yes, what is it that God is trying to accomplish? So those are some very cool things. And it brings us then, I think, just to reflect personally. Again, I think we're all at very different places with God. Just ask ourselves this question. Do you believe that, as Jesus says in Acts 20, verse 35, it is more blessed to give than to receive? Do you believe that? Do you believe that that's true? Well, I'm going to guess that there's nobody here that say, yeah, I got a real problem with that. Well, you might. And the more honest of us, of course, would. But Jesus says it's more blessed to give to receive, and do you believe Him? Do you believe Him? Look, this is the question about the whole orientation of your life. Do you believe that God's interest in you, based upon His goodness and His mercy, make it possible that we can say no to self, to live a life of being a blessing to others, and actually have that turn out to be a pretty good thing, a better thing, in fact, than if we went the other direction? Do you believe that's true? That's something you're going to have to resolve before God, because it has everything to do with how you orient your life from here on out. Will you, even here tonight, ask God to shape your heart? And just to come before Him and say, I'm a selfish, I can't say it on tape, but anyway, I'm not a nice fellow. Okay? I look in there and I see, and I'm grossed out and mortified by what I see. And I'm asking God, will You show me what does it take for me to respond to You so that my dark heart is really transformed by You, and that I can be the kind of person that Paul is described of in this great passage here. To be the kind of person who is really animated, excited, takes joy in moving into relationship with other people with real zeal and with the skills to, learning the skills at least, to become effective for what God's trying to accomplish through you in their life. It's a sweet thing. But these are decisions that we make. It's not something you just kind of fall into. It's not a rapids that you stumble off the bank into and are carried off. You have to decide, this is what I'm about. And then you have to begin to think, God, where are You taking me? seek him out in that way. Second point. It's a little bit longer text, but a shorter point. In verse 21, Paul says, whatever they dare to boast about, now he says, I'm talking like a fool again. I dare to boast about it too. Here again, he's talking about these people who are kind of his adversaries. He says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I know I sound like a madman, but I have served him far more. I have worked harder, been put into prison more often, been whipped times without number, and faced death again and again. 5 times the Jewish leaders gave me 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. Man, this guy's got a pretty long resume of crappy things that happened. 1, he says, I spent a whole night and day adrift at sea. I've had troubles on many long journeys. I have faced danger from rivers and from robbers. I have faced danger from my own people, the Jews, as well as from Gentiles. I faced danger in the deserts and on the seas. I have faced danger from men who claim to be believers but who are not. I have worked hard and long, endured many sleepless nights. I have been hungry and thirsty and have gone without food. I have shivered in the cold without enough clothing to keep me warm. Then he says in verse 28, besides all this, I have the daily burden of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak without my feeling that weakness? Who is led astray and I do not burn with anger? You know, if you understand this first point that we've been talking about, the idea that God is calling us to a different way, a way that says I predicate all of what I do, not on the basis of what's in it for me, but I predicate what I do on what can God do through me to others, then you can understand what Paul is describing here. You know, to be beaten, to be stoned, to be thrown in prison, all of these things Paul endured. And he endured them of his own free will. He didn't have to go through any of that stuff, but he chose to as a servant of Christ. And Paul describes here really what it takes to be effective, which is a mind to suffer. Does Paul's example that we're describing here produce in you a certain level of discomfort? And if it does, what is that discomfort that you feel? What do you think, Kelly?
I guess for myself, sometimes I think, like, when's the suffering going to end? And he doesn't seem to indicate that that's his motivation to keep following Christ.
Yeah.
You know, he keeps, you know, despite being beaten by the Jews once, I mean, he could have shut up after that, but he received other beatings and went on to other cities and served other churches.
You know, such a great point. Because isn't our expectation that, yeah, you know, things may be kind of crappy now, but there's light at the end of the tunnel.
This too shall pass.
This too shall pass, real good, yeah, yeah. And there, where is it written that that's the way it is?
Mm-mm.
You know, it's not. And so this example of Paul, who just one episode after another, this characterized his life. It wasn't the exception. And maybe it's also true that for some of us, and in very different ways, it will also be true of us.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. What do you think, Andrea? You got a thing right behind you.
I thought this is good because I think in loving neighbors and family, you know, there just seems maybe a constant role. Neighbors, friends, family, whoever, coworkers, customers, there can be a constant roll of complaints.
Yes.
And you can love, 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 and serve, and serve. And you can kind of get knocked off your boat.
Yes.
By all the complaints.
Yeah.
About you, about your character, about what you, how you didn't love them enough. And I think from what you're saying here is, you know, Paul didn't have this kind of agenda of waiting for all the praise.
That's right.
He endured this because he saw in the end there was something really good. And I think it's good. I think it's good to look at this passage and say, okay, I'm being a baby.
I'm
wanting something from these people, and maybe I shouldn't be wanting something from these people.
Okay, that's good. So it's what's uncomfortable about Paul's example is you realize, you know, I start suffering a little bit, and all of a sudden I feel like, you know, the sky is falling, the end of the world's at hand, and realize, you know, no, that's this is the way it is. It's real similar to Kelly's comment. Who else has a thought about this? What do you think, Jody?
Well, I like when we were going back to the servanthood and the self-orientation.
Yeah.
Speaking from someone who I think is on the same page as you, I'm glad you brought the heart into it, because I know if before, you know, a few months ago, before Christ was in my heart, I know when I would sit there and look at that, mm-hmm. or listen to you, so much guilt would wash over me in the kind of life I live, mm-hmm. and, you know, thinking, okay, now I got to have this checklist, I got to do this, I got to give more, I got to do that, and I just want to, you know, make that distinction that even if your entire life from morning till night is servanthood, if it doesn't come from your heart, or if he's not in your heart, you can't act your way to God, and you can't act your way out of it.
Yeah, that's such a huge point. You're right. You know, I think I look at this example of Paul, and it actualizes my worst fears of what if I decide to get serious about following Christ? What are the implications here? Am I going to be, you know, rejected and all that kind of stuff like Paul was and experienced kind of things that he did? I think what we tend to do is we look at the example of Paul and we say, that is different because, after all, who is Paul? Who is Paul? Faint Paul. That's a different species of person than I am. Even though, what does Saint Paul say? In 2 Timothy 1, verse 8, to his buddy Timothy. You know, he says, it's time for you to suffer along with me. God's not about the work of exempting us from pain and from suffering. He invites us to join in suffering. And so maybe it's going to mean something very different for you than it does for Paul, and that's fine, and it's probably not going to be that extreme. But to have a mind to say that discomfort is not a disqualification for me to continue to pursue the things of God is something that we're going to really have in our minds. Maybe Paul's motivation was the fact that he discovered something revolutionary, something that was really cool, namely that God is real, that the sacrifice is worth it, that there's nothing that you could be about that could come close to the significance of living your life for Christ. Maybe he found that out. Yes, I think he did. And he's calling on us. You can discover that same thing. Deep peace in your life. Real significance in what you accomplish. If you set aside self, if you set aside the idea that I quit if I suffer, and we just move on with Christ, then we will find something deep, as Paul did. You know, the Christian life is about taking risks, really, at the end of the day. You know, it's because we're willing to take risks that we're able to even experience God at all. To say, God, I'm going to take you on your word. I look around and I think, it's a dangerous thing to set aside my rights, my interests, my good for the good of another person. That runs contrary to everything I know. But you said so. And I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to step out, and I'm going to do that. That's the only way you will experience God in your life. What is God calling on you to do here tonight? To exercise faith, to take a risk, to take a step out of what's comfortable and predictable and known into a world of real obedience to his calling on your life. You know, without risk, what is faith anyway? It's just a philosophy. It's a theory. It doesn't really amount to anything concretely in your life. You'll see real change happen in your life when you say, okay, I will take this step. I will risk. I'll believe you, God, even at the expense maybe of my own experience. Paul was able to let his circumstances fall where they may. How about you? Can you do that? Can you say, God, I'm into what you're into. I want to follow you, and I'm not demanding that it look like this. You know, Paul experienced pretty bad circumstances, probably a lot worse than what you'll have to experience. But it's that attitude of the heart that says, I'm going to choose to go God's way, and I'm going to let him work out the details. Will you do that? Paul was willing in his relationships with people to risk rejection without offending them. You know, he was run out of town a whole bunch of times, not because he was a jerk. Most people are rejected because they're jerks, because they're offensive. But that's not true of Paul, and that wasn't true of Jesus, and doesn't have to be true of us either. That if we move toward people with the love of Christ and with the message of hope, and what he has accomplished for us. You know, there's a lot of people that will take offense at that and say, you know, who are you to say that this is the way it is? And, you know, I'm good enough and grace is just an excuse or, you know, whatever it is. And you and the horse you rode in on, you know, that. And I think probably if you haven't ever experienced a little bit of that, you probably haven't moved very far in the direction of the things that really matter in people's lives. Just a thought. And lastly, then, you know, so Paul is willing to put his circumstances in God's hands. He's willing to risk rejection in his relationships with people. And lastly, and I think very profoundly, he talks about, you know, who is weak without my constant concern? And you know, his daily concern, he says, for all the churches. You know, to let the needs and the concerns of other people loom really large in your heart is a big deal. And do you have room in your heart for the concerns of other people? And what does that look like, you know? Just that ability to really be impacted by and concerned about what's going on in another person's life that drives you to pray for them, that drives you to call them up and to pursue them, that maybe keeps you up at night, concerned for what may be happening in their life. You know, not to be neurotic and all this kind of stuff, but to just have in your heart something real about other people, that they matter to you more than you matter to yourself. You have that with your children, right? You'd do anything for your kids. Why did your love have to stop at the front door? Why? And so I think this is it's a gripping passage as Paul, more or less in a very transparent way, is just revealing his heart before these Corinthians. And he's saying, you know me. You know I didn't come for the sake of personal advantage. I came because I care for you more than I care about me. And that's why Paul had the profound impact that we did, and that's why we're willing to read his letters 2,000 years later. Let's be that kind of people. Why don't we pray together? Lord, you have called us to a really different way of looking at life and looking at our own lives and looking at what we're about. And we just think about, you know, this guy Paul and his ability to really authentically from the heart without lying address these people and tell them, you know what I'm about. I've never come to you asking you for anything. come, you know, to give you the gospel and to give you my life. And God, it's just the deep things, the important things, they're simple. At least simple to understand, but yet so very complicated when we get into that web that we've created around ourselves that insulates us from the clear things that you're calling on us to do. Help us tonight, Lord, to see what does it look like for us to be like Paul, the kind of person that is able to set aside self and to really drive for your purposes in the lives of the people around us. Help us be like that. Just thanks, God. You're not asking us to be martyrs. You're not, you're just asking us to put you first in real tangible and practical ways. And I thank you for the blessing that always comes from the desire to follow you and to be about the things that you're about. It's just so sweet, Lord. And thanks for this time together. I pray and trust, Lord, that you have had something to say to each one of us. And I pray that we'd have the, you know, just that humility there to grasp what it is that you're asking us to do in a practical way to respond to what you've laid on our hearts. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.